Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday, April 25th, 25 degrees, currently in Old Town Park City. Got a bit of blue sky poking out. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Giboy. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie. Happy Tuesday. And yeah, we're finally starting to see some blue sky, which is very nice change of pace, but we'll still hold on to a chance of seeing some snow showers as we go through the day in Park City. I think the best chance will mainly be this morning through the early stretches of this afternoon. But outside of any wet weather, we'll mainly see partly cloudy to partly sunny skies. So altogether, not going to be too bad of a day. But if we do see some additional showers, we could see some minor accumulations, but not expecting anything too much at this point, as the bulk of our storm system is now working its way away to the east. For today, the daytime high only topping out at 40 degrees in Park City, and with a northwesterly wind around 10 to 15 miles per hour, chances are it's going to feel a little bit chilly. But if you're not a fan of the cooler temperatures, there's good news in store, because we will start to feel like spring here relatively soon. But for tonight, the chance for snow comes to an end as we eventually drop back into the upper 20s. So we'll go to partly cloudy skies as we go into the overnight hours. And then for our Wednesday, high pressure will start to build in and establish itself, and the daytime high jumps by about 10 degrees by tomorrow afternoon. We'll climb to 52 degrees for our Wednesday. We'll become mostly sunny by the second half of the afternoon, and partly cloudy skies on Wednesday night with an overnight low of 31. And the warm-up will continue going into our Thursday and Friday. We'll mainly be in the middle 50s on Thursday, mostly sunny skies, and then mid to upper 50s possible on Friday as we get to around 56, 57 in Park City. But then the warm-up ramps up even more going into this upcoming weekend. I think we're going to keep mostly sunny skies during the day, mostly clear skies at night. On Saturday, the daytime high getting into the 60s in Park City, the overnight lows by the time we get into Saturday night into the upper 30s, and then could see lower 40s by Sunday night. But from Sunday into Monday, right now the forecast is for upper 60s, but there is a chance that on Monday we could get close to that 70 degree mark based on what I'm seeing in the models. There could be a slight chance for showers by next Monday and Tuesday. That doesn't look likely at this point, but it does look warm as we turn the page into this weekend and early next week, Leslie.
Okay. Thank you, Thomas.
You're welcome.
And once again, if you are headed into the backcountry to do a little few last turns, again, a reminder that you know what you're doing and be careful. As we reported, a number of human-triggered avalanches caused over the weekend. Again, either dealing with wet snow, we've got, of course, the new snow now to deal with, and that wind-drifted snow. So again, know before you go. Stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott. We'll be discussing the agenda for today's joint meeting with the Park City Council, as well as tomorrow's County Council meeting. Later on, People's Health Clinic CEO Mari Leining talking about an original research article that was recently published in an international journal on the success of the clinic's diabetes program. And finally, Park City Board of Realtors CEO Jamie Johnson will be in with Board President Joanne O'Connell. We take a look at the first quarter stats as well as last week's award winners. And stay tuned also for This Green Earth. You can hear This Green Earth again between 9 and 10. Well, taking a look at some local news now, some residents who live in Willow Creek Estates and Ranch Place are at high risk for flooding due to obstructions and obstacles there in Willow Creek. KPCW's Andrew Buchanan has this update.
Willow Creek meanders across lands owned by various individuals, HOAs, and Utah Open Lands managed by Basin Recreation. In a normal spring runoff, the creek would run from Old Ranch Road south to north, parallel in some sections to East Meadows Drive, and into the Swanner Preserve. But this spring, the creek has already gone rogue. The creek's banks breached Monday, April 17th, and caused a large water sheet to flow across Basin Recreation's open space and flood two homes on the south end of Angus Court. Gary Peacock lives in Willow Creek Estates. He said he's concerned about the creek flooding again because there are obstructions in certain areas.
Willow Creek, it has a half a dozen man-made obstructions, which are some kind of blockage, which they're like wood 2x4s that have been inserted for irrigation purposes back when all this land here near Willow Creek Estates was farmland, right, and wetland.
According to Peacock, there is some controversy over a historic irrigation headgate called the South Gate and whether it should be opened or not. Peacock said he learned recently that these gates had been put in by previous homeowners years ago.
But that metal gate has been open and closed. It's not secured. We don't know who can open it, Who can close it? Who's going to monitor it? Who owns it?
Peacock has been in communication with Summit County Council Member Chris Robinson and Ferris Gines, who is the Trails and Open Space Manager for Basin Recreation. He said there was a survey of the creek from Old Ranch Road north to Cutter over the weekend to get a better understanding of the issues and who is responsible for maintenance of the creeks and the obstructions. Gines said it's not clear who oversees the creek's maintenance, the individual HOAs, Summit County, or Basin Recreation.
So it doesn't mean that we're not willing to help. It's just that we got to be kind of careful not to just go into private property and start clearing things out. As far as the water itself, I honestly do not know who is in control of the water. I know there's a head gate that heads east out of Willow Creek itself. And I think it's been assumed that maybe Basin Rec was in control of that, but we are definitely not in control of that.
Gines said there's no clear path forward, but Basin Recreation is communicating with the county and homeowners associations. People from each organization plan to meet this week to figure out a game plan. But as the temperatures rise and the issues with Willow Creek remain, Peacock said he fears the worst is coming.
There's just finger pointing and not our property and stuff like that. We're facing a disaster because we're going to get warming weather, and we're going to get a lot more water going down that, and all these neighborhoods are endangered, in my opinion.
Sandbag stations are located in Willow Creek Park and throughout Summit County. For more information on flood preparation, visit the web version of this report at kpcw.org. Andrea Buchanan, KPCW News.
It's 8:13. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. The Summit County Council meets this morning in a joint session with the Park City Council, and then again tomorrow in its regular meeting that starts at 4 o'clock at the Richens Building. In the studio with a preview, I have Summit County Manager Shane Scott. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you this morning?
Doing well, thank you. So before we get to the agendas, let's talk a little bit about the flooding situation. Again, we're hearing that homes near the Willow Creek area could be in danger. Council Member Chris Robinson out there surveying the area last week and apparently has made several recommendations in an unofficial report. I guess the biggest question is here is who's responsible for getting the work done?
Well, I think everybody's kind of responsible for their own property. The county is here to help in ways that we can help. I listened to your report just barely, and there's a lot of good points there that are made. As you probably know, the waterways of the state of Utah are regulated by the state of Utah. And in order to alter those, you need a stream alteration permit, and you need to be able to get the permission of the state to get in there and do work. And so we're monitoring this, and we're communicating with the state and serving as that liaison maybe between the HOAs, the private property owners, and the state of Utah, and what may or may not need to be done in this area. We have a lot of concerns throughout the county. Willow Creek's not our only concern. We have over 50 HOAs that have various creeks running through them, so we have a lot of concerns in the county that we're monitoring and watching over the next couple of weeks as it starts to warm up.
Yeah, we had heard at 1.27 areas. Are we increasing that number?
I think that sounds about right from what I heard from Catherine last.
Okay. There are lots of private bridges over Willow Creek in particular, which certainly could be an impediment as the water rises. They'll get knocked downstream and then things back up. So do those need to be pulled off?
I think it would be great if those were pulled off. That's not something Summit County is going to do. Those are private bridges. We would have to access private property to do so. We need to get written permission from the owners to do so. They would, I'm sure, expect those bridges to be replaced. So if what we're focusing on right now is education, we'd like people to know that this is a concern, and we'd like them to act if they could. I wonder how many of those bridges were put in with the permit through the state. I think a lot of them probably weren't. And I think there's some concerns there, for sure. Our main focus in talking to John Angel with our Public Works Department has been on that check dam. And he's received permission from Basin Rec to get in there, and he'll be doing that the next couple of days, him and his workers, to deepen the channel, remove that check dam, and then hopefully remove some of those railroad ties that are in there, and hopefully that'll keep the water where it's supposed to be. That's one thing we can do, and we're going to do this week.
Okay. Apparently there's some meeting on Friday. I guess what do property owners need to know going forward?
I think it's, again, it's just education. I think what we're trying to do with Catherine, with our community involvement folks, is to just let people know to be aware of what could happen. As more water is in that channel, what do you think is going to happen? Is there going to be a blockage in one of those bridges that causes damage to other people? And if those can be removed, they should be removed.
All right. And then what are some of the other areas that you're really concerned about? I know we certainly saw a lot of flooding in the Francis area already.
Yes, we did. And that, I think we were able to mobilize very quickly. And I really think that's where the county can really shine is assisting in those different areas, whether that's in a municipality or in the unincorporated areas of the county. I know Silver Creek is something we're watching very closely. It's been holding pretty steady at about 7.5 feet, and we're not too concerned until it gets over 9 feet. But we're just getting more sandbags, more prep. We've got another 40,000 sandbags from the state, so I think we're ready. And flooding may or may not happen. We're doing all that we can to prepare for it and to mitigate it, but it may still happen somewhere.
Right, and with the temperatures really scheduled to warm up this week, that's going to be critical.
This is, I think, in the next couple of weeks is going to be very key for us.
Yeah. All right, well, moving on to this morning's joint meeting with the Park City Council. It's really just a 90-minute discussion with regarding housing with the Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Salt Lake City. So what is this, just to learn more about housing authorities?
Absolutely, that's exactly what it is. Mr. Nackerman's going to be there to make a presentation, and we'll be available for questions. One of the directives we've received from our council this year as part of our work plan is to vet out a housing authority and what that might look like in doing that in conjunction with Park City. So I think this is a perfect thing for us to discuss in a joint meeting. We've got Jeff Jones on our end there ready to talk about housing authorities and what the benefits might be, and I think we'll just get a lot of questions answered today.
Yeah, so we're talking about a regional housing authority as opposed, because Park City Council already
right.
has a housing authority.
I think that's it. I think, is there a difference between what they're doing now and what we could do regionally is really the key question today.
Yeah, and is Wasatch County being included in this?
I don't think they are in this discussion today.
All right, should they be included, though, in a housing authority? Seems to me that, you know, that's...
I think, at least for me, I probably could be better answer that question after today. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure, but we do obviously want to think regionally when it comes to Wasatch County and on some of these issues. And the housing, obviously, the market has trickled down there with the units they've got mm-hmm. entitled. That's going to be a major concern for us, and are the things that we can do to mitigate things.
Yeah, scanning through the staff report, there was an interesting point that the presenter makes in this presentation. One of the questions he asks, are we attracting the poor to the community by doing this?
Well, I guess I don't know the answer to that either, and I'm looking forward to listening to this, but I don't think we're focusing on income levels when it comes to attraction. I think we're trying to meet the needs of our community and whatever those are. And if that means someone to work at the ski resorts, those to fill the many needed jobs that we have here in Summit County. And as selfishly as a county employer, I'd like to see 100% of our employees live and work in Summit County. That would make for a better, more robust workforce. And that's where I'm coming at this, is what can we do to get some of our employees to live up here in the county.
So what are the targeted populations that the Housing Authority would serve?
Well, I think we're always looking at workforce housing. I think that's really a key. We have other housing available to us in spades, so I think workforce housing is really where our key focus is as an organization.
So what's next with this?
I think we're going to just look at this today, and then we'll probably have some internal discussions over the next. I hope we have a real movement on this by the fall in at least what we want to do, if anything.
All right. The regular meeting on Wednesday starts at 4 o'clock again at the Richland Services Building, starting with our interview for the vacancy on the North Summit Recreation Special Recreation District. Do you have an update? I mean, these guys, they have received some a tax increase. They've got some money. They've received some RAP grants. When are they going to start to move on some recreation projects?
I'm not sure. I know that there was one vacancy and we had one applicant, so that interview might not be the most exciting in the world, but Tyler's actually a county employee, so we know him very well. But I'm not very familiar with the North Summit Recreation Special Service District and the status of it.
Okay. Let's see, at 4:25, a discussion and possible approval of an ordinance amending the Eastern Summit County Water Conservancy's Special Service District. What changes are being made here?
I think this item and the one that follows are follow-ups to the discussion we had on the health department really taking over a lot of the Eastern Summit County solid waste issues. So I think they're, I think it's Nathan and Helen are coming to present that, and I think they got direction from the last time that we could move forward with taking this on in the interim, in the meantime, until the Water Conservancy Special Service District is up and running and can handle these requests by themselves.
Yeah, now this district was formed back in 2008, so it really hasn't even been used at this point.
It hasn't, and I think it's time over the next couple of years to really get it moving in the right direction.
Okay, and then the work session that follows this item, again, discussing the maintenance agreement used by this special service district. We're talking about local underground water districts. I mean, so are we talking about sewer systems or are we talking about septic systems?
Well, I think we're talking about getting rid of septic systems in favor of sewer systems. I think that's our ultimate goal. But I think it's exactly that. And there are those systems that come in the eastern side that I think this Water Conservancy Special Service District is not capable of managing. And obviously from the health department, this is a key thing that we do is water quality, making sure that the health and safety and wellness of our residents is paramount. And I think that's what the goal here is in the health department taking this on.
Okay. So that's who we should talk to then, the health department. They've got better idea of what's happening here.
Yes, absolutely. Nate and Helen are presenting that, and Mr. Bondurant will be at our meeting to discuss it as well.
Okay. Later on at about 5:10, a discussion and possible approval of an ordinance amending the Snyderville Basin Development Code regarding setbacks in the rural residential, hillside stewardship, and mountain remote zoning districts. This is to do what?
Well, they're defining the setbacks to ponds and different rivers. I don't know if you followed this a couple months ago. I think this might have been my first meeting. This came to us at the time, and I think our community development staff thought this was a little bit more ready to go than the council did. But in my estimation, every time someone modifies or adds something, if they're within those setbacks, they have to go through a really laborious variance process. And I think we're trying to just match the character of these neighborhoods with these ponds and allow people to do some things to their homes that they would normally be able to do if they weren't within a man-made pond. So I think we're trying to differentiate some of the different ponds and then we got into a conversation about some of the bigger lakes in our community, and I think we're just trying to make this a little bit easier to do some things that our residents want to do.
All right, and then finally at 6:00, a public hearing. This is regarding an amendment to allow multifamily residential as part of a commercial development. Part of this is to increase the minimum height limit in service commercial zones from 32 to 45 feet. It would also reduce the front yard setback requirements from 30 feet to 20 feet from the property line. Are we talking about a specific location, or is this for all service commercial zones in the county?
I think some of this could affect other locations, but I think this is the only zone of this type we have in the county. I think it's a specific use. I believe it's a climbing gym that would like to have this higher limit. And after the Planning Commission did a really good job of vetting this out, I think they were very careful about what we're doing here, making sure we don't set any precedents. I read through the public hearing notice a couple of times, and that's my understanding of it. I did reach out to our community development staff. I do want to speak to them about this before Wednesday, but I haven't had the chance to do so. But I think this looks good, and I'm very proud of that Planning Commission for how well they've vetted this out.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with this. but the way reading the staff report shows that the applicant, again, wants to build this climbing gym but can't because of the height restriction. So the applicant applied to add dwelling units, multifamily, as part of a commercial development to make this happen. So are we talking about building a climbing gym, or are we talking about building multifamily units.
Well, I think they're both of those have a piece in this, but I believe that's kind of what my question was, Leslie, is what do we just change maybe what we're asking the applicant to ask for in an effort to give it to them? But I do think what the request on its face is reasonable, and I think it makes sense in that location, and those are the questions I wanted to ask Ray before we got into this.
Well, and I know some council members do not like special exceptions, but it seems to me that this makes sense in this case.
I believe that as well, and I think we want to be very careful about special exemptions. We want to make sure that we're, again, matching the character of our neighborhoods and putting things in the right place, and I think that's what the Planning Commission did, is they were trying to be very, very careful about what we do here.
All right. Does the planning staff support this change?
I think they do, yes.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to report?
We had the EMS study that came out last Tuesday, a week ago today, and I think it was very well received. We've given some comments to the consultant for them to go back and put together a final report, which we presented to the council in May, maybe late May. And mm-hmm. I think we're excited about some of the options and the models they presented. And I think over the next couple of weeks, we're just going to try and speak about that internally whenever we get the chance and get our fire district chiefs together and some of the board members and see if we can't figure out the best way to manage this very important system in our county.
Okay, this just, I think, it started with like North Summit, and now South Summit also interested, in taking on their own EMS systems?
I think they're at least open to those negotiations, and mm-hmm. I think if you looked at those models, the first one was obviously the county does this independent of those fire districts. I think model two is the North Summit and South Summit and Park City do their own, and then I think model three was North Summit and South Summit combine to do one Eastern District, and Park City does its own. So all of those are really good options and have their own pros and cons and financial impacts, and I'm really excited to really dig into this and come up with some good solutions.
Okay, we'll definitely see this come back then.
We will.
Okay, Shane, thank you.
Leslie, thank you. Have a great day.
Shane Scott is the manager of Summit County. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the Heber City Council and a special committee directing the Envision Central Heber project will be at the city's Planning Commission meeting this week. KPCW's Connor Thomas has a preview.
The biggest item on Tuesday's meeting agenda is a discussion of the Envision Central Heber plan. It's a smaller part of the Envision Heber 2050 plan formulated a few years ago, which didn't go into the minutia needed to redesign the city center. This week's meeting will revise those plans for the fastest growing micropolitan city in America. That's according to 2018 Census Bureau data. Micropolitan describes communities with between 10,000 and 50,000 residents. A steering committee has been appointed to oversee Central Heber planning, and it will work on a draft map of central neighborhoods and potential uses with the city council and planners. That map is in the online version of this report at kpcw.org. The map shows a lively and bustling intersection at Center Street and Main Street, with a historic walk and network of bike paths running through the city center. The Trails and History Walk follow a mixed-use corridor to the west side of town, which could be a recreation and tourism district. That would encompass the old train station, trailheads, a rec center, and a new school. The central neighborhoods surrounding Main Street should remain quiet, the plan says. Ideas discussed at the meeting will be used to modify the general plan in the future and draft city ordinances to make sure development proceeds accordingly. But the central city discussion is just a work session, so public comment will not be taken. The Planning Commission is not voting Tuesday, and the public can weigh in at a future meeting. The Planning Commission will also consider simplifying and revising two portions of municipal code, as well as approving the site of a new Wasatch County Fire Station at 200 East and 1200 South. The meeting is Tuesday at 6 at the City Administration Building, 75 North Main Street. We'll include a link to attend virtually as soon as it's posted. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the People's Health Clinic had a research paper published in a medical journal, and in the studio with details, I have the CEO of the People's Health Clinic, Mari Lining. Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to see you, Leslie.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being here. So is this the first ever research paper that People's Health Clinic has had published?
I believe so, and it's an original article on our diabetes program that we ran as a quality improvement initiative from October 2020 to October 2021.
Okay, so what does it mean to be published in a medical journal?
Well, it means that we are doing very real, very high-level work at the clinic, such that we're developing protocols and reaching the standard of care in a way for a unique population that is worthy of an international journal.
All right. Well, before we get into kind of the research, who did this for you? You or somebody else or just a team?
So I was the medical director of the program, and I initiated the quality improvement process, but it was a team effort. We had what we call team diabetes that involved case management, an incredible nurse, diabetic educator, wonderful medical assistants, Dahlia Gonzalez, who's now our operations director, and then, of course, our providers, who at that interval in time still included John Hanrahan, as well as Rochelle Flynn, who's now our assistant medical director.
Okay, so why was this something you wanted to do?
Well, the reason I joined the People's Health Clinic in 2019 was in part because of a patient who presented to the intensive care unit when I was the director at the Park City Hospital for the ICU. And he had incredibly uncontrolled type 2 diabetes that was really preventable. And when I was discharging him to the hospital, I just realized he needed much more intensive services than were available and that were beyond the capacity of the People's Health Clinic at that point. And that was really kind of a coming to moment for me where I shifted what I do as a physician.
All right. So to prepare the research for that, I mean, how difficult is it to do something like this?
It took a lot of work. I did about 3 months of research before starting the program, both in, you know, what is optimal diabetes management, and then what is feasible given a free community clinic without federal funding and patients who are not eligible to receive first-line drugs easily. I am not a diabetologist. My background is hospital medicine. Again, I was the ICU medical director, so this was different for me, going to outpatient management versus inpatient management.
And then so once the research is done and the report written, then you just submit it to a particular journal, or I mean, how does that work?
So the process itself took a year. I'm finishing my master's in public health at Johns Hopkins, and I actually use their statistics department there because we have a lot of unique characteristics in our patient population that have not been studied before and really should be evaluated for us to understand how best to reach the undocumented immigrant population and actually make differences in health outcomes. And so utilizing their department, and then I wrote the article, but really my medical assistants, Nina Chartrand, who does a lot of our data collection at the clinic, they were meticulous in putting the data together such that I could analyze it along with the help of statisticians.
So this, I had reported, was an international journal, which I think is important because we are talking about undocumented immigrants, huh?
Yeah, so Acta Diabetologica, which is the journal that published our article, is the leading diabetes journal in Europe. And I think they were particularly fascinated by this topic. In the review process, there are a lot of things they didn't understand. For example, the reviewers asked, well, I don't see why everyone can't just have those first-line medications. And what do you mean they don't have health insurance? Mm-hmm. And why does your town have this huge wealth gap? So I gained a lot of insight just speaking to a European audience that has, you know, a much more socialized view of healthcare.
Okay, so let's talk about the research itself. As you've told us, it was for improving diabetes care for undocumented immigrants using what's called the chronic care model at a free community clinic. So this chronic care model is an international thing, or I mean,
it is. It's something that's been utilized for many years in, you know, the management of chronic disease. So, you know, nothing we did was inventing new medical techniques. This wasn't a primary human research study. This was really a quality improvement initiative asking, can we provide the very highest expected level of diabetes care to a population who has everything going against them when it comes to diabetes management? And what we proved in this one-year program is the answer is yes. Like, we can overcome social determinants of health. We overcame food insecurity issues in our partnership with the Christian Center. We overcame the need to apply to get free medications with help from our partner, Holy Cross Ministries. You know, utilizing these community resources and really driving the notion of community impact. And I also have to mention Intermountain Healthcare and the University of Utah, both of whom made this possible. It shows that as a community, we can make a difference.
Yeah. So we're talking about folks just with type 2 diabetes. Is that correct?
Almost all of them. I think we have five individuals in the cohort with type 1 diabetes.
Okay. So those that were part of the study knew that they were part of the study then, huh?
They knew that they were part of the program. Although we did not do the program with the intention of making it a study, it was a quality improvement initiative to improve health outcomes. And what we found 12 months in was that the degree to which we were able to successfully not only lower blood sugars, but also provide basic diabetic health care, such as routine eye exams, foot exams, access to community resources. Those findings were significant, and that's what made us turn this into a secondary data analysis of a quality improvement initiative.
And that's interesting that you mentioned the foot exam. I mean, just having a grandmother who lost part of her leg as a result of, right, a stubbed her toe and nobody saw it, right? And then you got problems. What about the eye issues? What does diabetes do to your eyesight?
So if you have uncontrolled diabetes, meaning unregulated blood sugar, you get diabetic retinopathy, which is actually the leading cause of blindness in the United States. And there are interventions that can be done. There are many different treatment options, but you need to have an ophthalmologist diagnose you, and then you need to be tied in to get those services. And we have been very fortunate in our longstanding partnership with the Moran Eye Center at the University of Utah, and we have an incredible ophthalmologist who comes in once a month and will see 20 patients in an evening.
Wow. So this chronic care model, is it used only for diabetes? I mean, if it works, if this study was successful in diabetes care, what about high blood pressure and other chronic disease?
Yeah, it can be used for that as well. Really, for any chronic disease management, coronary artery disease, kidney disease. What the chronic care model is asking you to do is to have a very holistic view of what it takes to actually make a difference in someone's life that's substantial and longstanding.
And does it all come down then to food, the food people eat and the exercise that they do?
In this patient population?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, it's much more complex. Yes, that's the food you eat, but I found that among our adult patients, 58% met criteria for food insecurity. So it's not just making healthy choices, it's how do we get you access to food that is healthy? Historically, our patients, you know, have been called like non-compliant for not showing up to medical appointments, and you know, really digging into why are they not showing up, and we found out it's because some of them were being labor trafficked and couldn't get a day off for 60 days. We found that others would get fired if they showed up, or that others were depending on a friend of a friend to get a ride. If there was a snowstorm, everyone needed to make money shoveling snow. So when you start to take into all of these different factors, we really had to design a very flexible clinic where patients decided what day and time would be best for them to return on their schedule. And for people who are unable to make it in, we did some home visits. We dropped stuff off at workplaces a few times. We really tried to meet individual needs and ask what those are.
Yeah, so the folks that were part of this study, I mean, what did you see then in terms of reducing their, you know, their diabetes?
So a really significant reduction in average blood sugar. In the medical community, we look at hemoglobin A1C, glycated hemoglobin, but, you know, for the purpose of this conversation, really, we brought people's blood sugars down from like 300 to 100 to 150. And once you're down into that safer range, your risk of heart disease, kidney disease, blindness, foot amputation goes down substantially.
Okay. So I guess how does this research get used then in the future?
I really want this research to do two things. One is make my patient population known. The undocumented immigrant population is sparsely evaluated in the research. They're not part of the census data. And unless something is measured, it doesn't exist. And if it doesn't exist, I can't get funding for it. And so part two is I would love for this study to get out there showing that, yes, we absolutely can address these social determinants of health. They're not just these concrete walls that we can't surpass. Like, we did it. And if we work together, we can do this for diabetes and many other issues.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the clinic does not receive federal funding. I mean, what kind of funding are you looking for then?
We are very dependent on private donors in town, and we're fortunate to be in Park City, which has an open heart toward the nonprofit community. We also apply for state-level grants and, like, family foundation grants. But because we're not federally funded, for example, it's very hard to sustain funding for, like, a diabetic educator or for all of the diabetes supplies that we would like to provide.
Yeah. And I guess any other findings that you wanted to, that you thought were just kind of stood out for you, that you wanted to note?
And I think the biggest finding that we took as a team and that our patients took, which is the most important, is that we can make a difference. So in the Latinx culture, there's this concept of fatalismo, like fatalism, like you can't, you know, once diagnosed with diabetes, you're not going to get better, you're going to die from it. There's nothing that anyone can do about it. And so overcoming that with our patients by showing them the reduction in the blood sugar and our patients feeling much better physically and the pride that they took in that was very rewarding for us. But I mean, having been a physician now for more than 20 years, there's fatalismo in the medical community as well, this feeling that, well, if somebody's in poverty and they don't speak English and they don't have health insurance, how am I gonna fix them? Like, I can fix them for a week, but what am I really gonna do? And you start to become cynical. And so this paper is really the anti-cynicism. It says, no, actually, if you do the right things with a great team, you make a difference.
All right, so is there gonna be follow-up then with this kind of cohort?
There are so many different initiatives going on at the clinic right now, looking at this patient population from different aspects. Again, with the goal being, how can we support our patients? What do they need? And what needs to be known about them so we can get them the resources they need? And so we now have Tanya Bodnar leading our women's health department, and she's looking at many of these factors in obstetric prenatal population. We have Lindsay Broadbent, who's now running our mental health department, and she's looking at the social determinants of health as they apply to the very unique mental health issues she sees. We have actually a pretty mature research paper that I'm working on now with the epidemiology department at the University of Utah on latent tuberculosis in our community and, you know, what can we do to reduce TB risk. So we have a lot going on. I think we're and we now have a research department.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Anything else you wanted to mention?
Just that I appreciate being on your show, and thank you for highlighting the People's Health Clinic.
You're welcome. Mari Leining is the CEO of the People's Health Clinic. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:45. Well, Utah reported one of the lowest unemployment levels in the country for March, 2.4%. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on that.
Utah's Department of Workforce Services released its monthly jobs report Friday morning. It told a story common around the country. Unemployment is low, and it's hard for businesses to find suitable candidates for open positions. But the report shows some changes on the horizon. Department of Workforce Services chief economist Mark Nold said the state added 44,100 new non-farm jobs last year. He said, quote, the state's labor force continues to find a supply of workers, end quote. That might mean businesses are filling their open slots, slowly but surely. He said, quote, we are seeing the rate of job openings coming down from the COVID-era peak a year ago. The rate of job openings is still higher than anything seen before the pandemic, and available jobs are still plentiful, end quote. Of significance to ski tourism, Utah's leisure and hospitality services added the second largest number of jobs over the past 12 months. That's behind education and health services. There were 7,500 more leisure and hospitality employees statewide this March than in March 2022, an almost 5% increase. And Summit County saw a total job increase of about 7% over the last year, over 2,000 jobs. Wasatch County's numbers are holding steadier than Summit's with an increase of 428 jobs, but that's still almost 4% more than last March. Utah's unemployment rate for March 2023 was 2.4%. A full point lower than the national rate of 3.5. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
KPCW News time, now 8:47. Joining me now in the studio with a look at the first quarter stats as well as the 2022 award winners, I have Park City Board of Realtors CEO Jamie Johnson, along with the president of the board, Joanne O'Connell. Good morning.
Good Good morning, Good morning. Leslie.
Let's start with the announcement of the annual awards from the party last week. First off, Realtor of the Year, that went to Jessica Allen Bateman. I mean, how is this award figured? I mean, is it based on sales or more than that?
Actually, it is. Production is not taken into consideration on any of our awards. Many years ago, they did base it a bit off of production and involvement with the association. And because the local brokerages do their own production awards, we went directly to what our members are doing within the community as well as with our association. And for Jessica, I mean, she just knocks it out of the park. She's now in her second term as a board of director member of the Park City Board. And then she also sits on the Camas City Council. So she ran and is obviously volunteering her time. I said anyone who volunteers the time and signs up to be on a council deserves some kind of award. She definitely does that, as well as she's an active realtor member and has been for, I think, over 15 years, as well as a mom and a wife, and keeps it all together. So a very deserving award for Jessica.
All right, and the Director's Award went to Taladere. What's that award for?
That's something that us, the board of directors, we recognize somebody who really helps us out and really helps the community and keeps it all together and informs us and makes our job easier, makes us look good. And Tal is so available and he's so involved and he's so knowledgeable. And even though it is a paid position, he goes way over and above. I think Jamie has said she talks to Tal every day more than anybody else. So he's really important to the board of directors.
Absolutely.
All right, the Affiliate of the Year Award went to Nanette Bush and her business?
Yes, absolutely. So Nanette is with Fairway Mortgage, and she has been in the real estate industry for over 30 years. The person who nominated her said he did transactions with her back in the day down in Salt Lake, and then she moved her business up here. She is an advocate for the realtor community, comes in, sponsors our events. She actually teaches.
So many committees. She's been in so many committees year after year after year.
Yeah, and she also teaches at the board as well. So classes that are related to mortgage or lending. She has one of our most successful classes, which is financing resort real estate. So she is very active and very involved and has been overlooked for many years. So very exciting for her to get that.
And then Meritorious Service Awards went both to Kurt Peterson and Michelle Eastman.
Yeah, so this is all of the awards. I mean, there are multiple candidates that are nominated by our membership. So the members actually make nominations, and then we have a special awards committee of members who have been around our board for many years who take in the nominations and consider those and have conversations about them. And so they are actually who vote and choose who the winners are. And this year, they just felt like both of these individuals deserved some kind of recognition. Kurt Peterson, he works with the Peterson Calder team, primarily in the Colony and with Berkshire Hathaway. He has, again, been in real estate for many years. We laughed and said before he came into real estate, he was known as the town banker. So many people in the community know him, and he's had a big impact. He also was very influential in helping us get into the current building that we have. When we built our building over on Prospector, he was someone that helped get that kind of from concept to making it happen. So they were super excited to honor him. And then Michelle, do you want to talk about Michelle Eastman? Has been around with us for many years. She also has been the president of our philanthropic foundation. So we have our own 501c3 that gives back to the community. And during the COVID years, she held a two-year term as our president. And she was also during that time going in and using her RN background to give shots for COVID vaccinations. So she did that and then was also reaching out to the community to find out where the needs were during that time so that we could, as a real estate community, give back to our community in a big way.
Anything you want to add to that, John?
No, I think she's just been so involved and so kind. She's one of those people that just shines for the whole community and not just the board. She's just out there making, you know, everybody's lives better.
Great. And then the Community Service Award went to PC Tots.
Mm-hmm. And that's exciting because they were established, I'm not sure how many years ago, but it was some locals who said, you know what, we need a child care program that's, you know, multicultural and something where everybody in the community can participate and the kids can all grow up together and everybody can kind of develop together. And so we just thought that's something we should really recognize, especially today. We're trying to kind of reach out to all the different diversities in Per City.
Yeah, and obviously they're right next door to us on Prospector, so that's nice. And then we have multiple realtor members who sit on their board. So Sarah Warbelow, who was the former president of the chamber, sits on their board. Mary Leader sits on their board. And so they nominated them as someone in our community who is making a big difference. And then we also give a $500 donation to the organization to help them in their endeavors as well.
Nice. All right, well, let's take a look at the first quarter stats for 2023. Joanne, maybe your assessment as we head into the new year.
So similar to the fourth quarter of last year, we really, that's a lot of us were talking about how it's just so similar. Everything's kind of stabilizing, and there isn't anything really striking to look at except new development, like the Jordanelle area, Mayflower, Silver Creek Village, all the new development is what's really selling, but the rest of Park City is just kind of stabilizing, and we really are waiting to see what this second quarter is going to do, because if we get more inventory on the market, that could really make a change.
Right, and the press release describes the market closer to normal, so what's normal?
Okay, so we're calling normal, because really what is normal? We're saying, how about let's just take COVID out of the situation and look back at like 2012 to 2019, and let's average those years and come up with, okay, what was going on then? And then we were so stable and we were increasing like 6% every year and everything was kind of normal. So we're trying to compare ourselves to that time because COVID was just an anomaly.
Okay, so that's what, now yes, I understand yes. why you're averaging, lumping all those 7 years together, just to kind of give you some kind of basis.
Right. And they were all very similar. There wasn't a year that, you know, prices jumped up or volume jumped up. They were all really stable years. We just kept increasing, you know, 6 to 7% year after year after year.
All right. So what about sales numbers? What do those look like then? We're back to what was normal.
We are, yeah. We're back to the days when sales were normal and we didn't have crazy increases in prices. And actually, we're a third lower than what the inventory was before COVID. So back in the normal days, our inventory was where it was. We're a third below that. So our inventory is still so low that it's hard to not, people say, well, aren't prices going to start dropping? Well, they can't because our inventory is so low.
Interesting, though, that with all of the new development, it's still low?
Right, I guess because a lot of those new developments sold like crazy during COVID, right? So now we have a few, like Silver Creek Village and Mayflower that I mentioned, but we don't have a lot of new developments around Park City with product to sell. So there's just small areas, small pockets.
All right. What about sales prices? It sounds like those are not returning to pre-pandemic levels.
They're still, number one, we don't think we're ever going to go back to pre-pandemic levels, but I think what we all believe is the reason they're not dropping is because we have no inventory. So, you know, when people want to buy and there's one home available in the area that they want, there isn't much dickering on the case of the buyer. So prices just don't have the ability to drop right now. And that'll be interesting to see what happens this next quarter. Do we have a lot of people that say, okay, I just went through a crazy, wonderful winter, and okay, maybe I want to move somewhere else, sunny and warmer now. So we're waiting to see what's going to happen to inventory this next quarter.
All right. Now, are sellers, I mean, are they having to reduce their prices that they could have gotten a couple of years ago?
Prior to COVID, or you mean during COVID?
Yeah, during COVID.
During COVID, there were multiple offers on everything, right? So yes, now sellers are being a little more realistic and we're maybe more comp-based. Before it was, well, let's just throw a number out there because we're going to get 20 offers on it. Now people have to be more realistic. Sellers have to really think, okay, well, what is going on and what has sold in my neighborhood?
Right. But also, if you look at the single family numbers for average and median, it's still a steady increase. Mm-hmm. So even if you go back to 2020, 2021, 2022, coming to 2023, we're still seeing on those median and averages a steady increase. So it's not like it's going back down drastically, except in the area like the Jordanelle where there is a lot of inventory.
Right.
So you've got more product, so it's a little bit more competitive. And so the prices have come down just a little bit. the areas where the product is lower or there's not as much inventory, prices are staying high.
Yeah. It's really inventory driving this entire bus, and that's why that's what we're all keeping our eyes on, is our inventory.
Hmm. And then if you also look at interest rates, obviously interest rates are still mm-hmm. high for those individuals who have a mortgage on their current home. They probably have a 3-4% rate, and they don't want to lose that rate. If they sell and they have to go and finance something else, then they're financing at a much higher rate. So many people are hesitant to put their house back on the market or on the market at this point mm-hmm. because they know they can't find something else comparable at a rate that they could afford.
Yeah, that's significant, right? I mean, they're basically doubled, right?
Right. And that's the other reason that buyers are a little slower of coming back and looking at the market, is they think, well, 7%, do I really want to do that? And there's so much talk first, interest rates are going to go up and then go down. I just think it makes people a little hesitant.
All right. And then just in terms of the rate of sales, that's the number of units sold, actually dropping by about mm-hmm. a third for homes itself, 41% for condos. That's pretty significant.
And those are compared to COVID years, right? Okay. So if you go back to before COVID, to the normal years, those numbers aren't so drastic. That's why I struggle with comparing whatever's going on now to COVID. COVID was, like I said, an anomaly. I just don't think we should compare to those years.
All right. And then in terms of, you say we're going to look forward to the second quarter. When are the most homes sold?
Well, and that's really interesting. We usually see a huge influx of inventory during the winter, which we didn't get, right? And now we're waiting. We're usually April and May, a lot of homes come on the market because that's when people looking to move here full time or come this summer are looking to buy. And some people have been saying, well, I've got sellers, but they're waiting for the snow to clear so everything's pretty and the flowers are popping. And some people are saying, well, I don't know. My clients just aren't looking to sell this season. So it's going to be so interesting to see how many people decide to put their homes on the market April, May.
Or maybe how many of those individuals that moved here during COVID experienced this winter and are ready to go back to where they came from. Who knows?
No, it's been wonderful.
Well, then we look forward to hearing the second quarter stats.
Yes, yeah, we're all excited for second quarter stats. Absolutely.
Okay, anything else you wanted to add real quick?
Anything? No. I don't think so. I mean, I think it's, as we say in our press release, this definitely shows you how you need a local expert. So you need that local realtor that knows this market, knows these neighborhoods. So make sure that if you're looking to buy or sell in the Wasatch Back, that you're reaching out to a member of a Park City Board of Realtors.
Good plug, Jamie. Good one.
Okay. All right, Jamie Johnson, Joanne O'Connell, thanks for your time. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.